G.K. Chesterton is one of the great Catholic literary figures of the early 20th century. His legacy continues to this day, particularly in the area of education. Chesterton expert Dale Alquist joins Crisis Point today to just talk about how Chesterton still has an impact, and particularly in the Chesterton schools. Hello, I'm Eric Sammons, your host and the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Before we get started, I just want to encourage people to like this video, to subscribe to the channel, let other people know about it. We always appreciate when you do that. Also, you can follow us on social media. Most social media outlets, we're at Crisis Mag. We're on Facebook, Twitter, all the alternative ones as well. Okay, so let me introduce our guest here. Dale Alquist is president of the Society of the Gilbert Keith Chesterton, creator and host of the EWTN series G.K. Chesterton, The Apostle of Common Sense, and the publisher of Gilbert Magazine. He's the author of 5 books and the editor of 12. He has been called probably the greatest living authority on the life and work of G.K. Chesterton. He is also the co-founder of Chesterton Academy, a classical high school in Hopkins, Minnesota, which is the flagship of the Chesterton Schools Network, which now includes 50 high schools worldwide. Welcome to the program, Dale.
Thank you, Eric. It's a delight to be with you.
So it seems to me like you're the guy, you're the go-to guy when it comes to Chesterton. I know you have that EWTN program, right? That goes through it. I've seen parts of that. I haven't seen the whole thing, but yeah, I mean, whenever, if you want to know anything about G.K. Chesterton, I think we should go to you.
Well, I'm delighted to play that role. It was a passion that has just led to many good things. My own interest in Chesterton has been very fruitful.
That's great. That's great. So why don't you give us, I think most of our audience probably already is familiar with Chesterton, at least on a broad scale. Why don't you give us though a brief biography of Chesterton, and you know, just so we can kind of make sure everybody who's watching this knows who he is.
Well, you said a broad scale. Let's start with that. It would take a broad scale to weigh G.K. Chesterton. He's a giant among literary figures and among intellectuals of the 20th century, but just a giant too. He was the guy who said he could stand up on a bus and offer his seat to 3 women at one time. But besides his great size, he did have the great intellect and the great humility that accompanied that powerful intellect. He was a very lovable, witty gentleman who got along with his opponents and didn't have any enemies. He really knew how to speak the truth in a loving and witty and creative way, so that his writings and speeches have just had a ripple effect over the last century. He did all his writing in the early 20th century, one of the most prolific writers who ever lived, and was a very famous Catholic convert. Wrote a book called Orthodoxy, The Everlasting Man, 2 of his most important books, but also the Father Brown series that continued to live on, like Sherlock Holmes for Arthur Conan Doyle. And I think one of the great things about Chesterton is how prophetic he is. My great interest in Chesterton is the fact that he seems to be writing for our time now, even though he was writing 100 years ago, when he says things such as, we are learning to do a great many clever things. The next thing we're going to have to learn is not to do them.
Yeah, I think one thing that you mentioned about Chesterton, I think really sets in part, because you say a great intellect, but which of course he did, but he combined that with a great humility, which, let's be honest, is actually rare to have that combination. It seems like the smarter people are, in today's world at least, the less humble they are because they look down on everybody. But of course, there's the famous story about when you ask what's wrong with the world, his famous answer of I am, just showed his humility. I think that's something about him that is needed today, because I mean, our world is full of experts and we're supposed to follow the experts. And frankly, most of the experts that are tried out there have a certain arrogance towards the common man. But that was the opposite of G.K. Chesterton, wasn't it?
Yeah. In fact, you bring a good point up. He never trusted experts because he trusted the wisdom of the common man, the ruck of the normal people, because experts tend to not be normal. And I think in a way he wished that he were more normal, because he knew he wasn't like anyone else, but he championed the people who were the common sense people, because common sense was what he was trying to bring to a world that really had gone off its rocker already with strange philosophies and truly arrogant ideas. It's the best way to describe it.
Now, what led you specifically to become so interested in Chesterton, to make it really your life's work to study the man and to try to follow in his footsteps?
Well, I was an evangelical, a Baptist, and I was a big C.S. Lewis fan. And C.S. Lewis is often the doorway to Chesterton. People want to find out what's the influence behind C.S. Lewis. And they learn quickly if they ask that question that it's Chesterton. And once I discovered Chesterton, really never went back to C.S. Lewis after that.
No offense to C.S. Lewis, but he probably actually would be happy with that. You know,
yeah, no offense whatsoever to C.S. Lewis.
Yeah. Now, what was your what is your favorite Chesterton book?
So what's the next question, Eric?
What? Yeah.
The question after that one.
You don't want to limit it to one, do you?
No, sorry.
Yeah. Now, what are his most popular, though? Everlasting Man, Orthodoxy, are those probably the biggest two?
Let's list the top six, I think. There are certainly those two, Orthodoxy, Everlasting Man. I think his book on St. Thomas and his book on St. Francis are key books that should be read of Chesterton. You alluded to the famous conversation, What's Wrong with the World? That line doesn't come from that book, but that's a book also that people... very prophetic book, What's Wrong with the World. And then let's just throw the Father Brown stories in there.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, and really it is kind of hard because, I mean, the thing I notice when I read Chesterton is that he's got just a way of both being an easy read, but a hard read. I don't even know how to describe it.
Paradoxical, like the man himself right there.
Eric. Right, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's not like he's using these big, huge words and trying to sound smart to everybody, but yet you are working in a certain sense when you read him because he's really bringing out a lot and he's making you think. So I think that's probably the biggest part is he's really making you think, see things in a different way. And I think, wouldn't you say that's probably part of his genius then?
Yes. Yeah, I totally agree with that. He makes you think, but also to see things in a different way. It's that wonderful paradoxical approach where truth is not what you expect it to be. Sometimes it's the opposite of what you expect it to be. And he has this way of inversion that is sometimes maddening, always amusing, and always enlightening.
Now, today, you've mentioned that he's important today. What specifically about Chesterton makes him a good model today for us to look to in our frankly kind of crazy modern world?
Well, I'm glad you already brought up his humility. I consider Chesterton, a potential for sainthood because of his heroic virtue. He was a virtuous man, and people are drawn to his goodness. They're certainly drawn to his great intellect, his ability to explain things, his ability to encapsulate really complicated truths in just one sentence with one great quotable line. And yet in the end, what you're drawn to is the innocence of the man and the humility and the goodness of the man. His virtue has that effect. And I think that's one of the reasons he's needed today. I think we need more models of lay Catholic spirituality.
Yeah, I think there was a quote going around. Who was it? Oh, it was the Prime Minister of Italy who quoted him about the thing about what was it like saying that the grass was green in the summer or something like that would be fought over.
Yep.
I mean, how did he see that?
I know. And that's kind of what when you read Chesterton, you go, how did he know that? But he predicted that we'd have to fight for proclaiming the truth that the grass is green. It would be that fundamental. Could you, what is a woman?
Yeah, right. I mean, that's the thing, because 100 years ago when he lived, I imagine nobody would have thought that would even be a debate, these type of things. Yet he basically saw it when nobody else did.
Yeah, he said early on, so the problem today is that the two sexes are each trying to be both sexes at once. He said that. And that was kind of led to the confusion right there.
Right. And nobody really was seeing that yet. I mean, that wasn't until probably 50 years later, people started seeing that a little bit. So, I mean, it really was prophetic in the sense of being able to see things clearly that other people could not. So, one thing I wanted to bring up about Chesterton, and it's, I personally think it's kind of dumb, but I want to bring it up anyway, is that recently there was some controversy about his alleged anti-Semitism. And I feel like people are going to be like, well, they want to hear what the real story on that because they saw this on Twitter and social media. Why don't you go ahead? And I kind of know it, but I want to make sure. Why don't you go ahead and just address that, this idea that somehow Chesterton was an anti-Semite?
Well, I will say that there's two kinds of people that accuse Chesterton of anti-Semitism. Those who don't know any better and those who do. So it's either out of ignorance or it's out of malice. There are some people who just don't like Chesterton and they want to bring him down and they can't argue with him, so they make the accusation. And that's the kind of the poisonous accusation these days. If you can do that, then you don't have to go to step two. You don't have to have any more arguments. He can be dismissed out of hand. And it really is just a facile attempt to dismiss Chesterton altogether. Because he wrote so much, I mean, just an incredibly prolific writer, people will find little things in there that say, oh, that's awful, but they always take them out of context. Chesterton was a critic of many Jews who unfortunately were not good people, but he wasn't casting anything against the whole Jewish people. In fact, he often defended the Jews when they were very unpopular. He was the one defending them, not only on a personal basis with personal friends, but on a large scale basis too. You see, the thing is, Chesterton criticized everybody, and you know, so the Jews were no exception. But he also criticized the Germans, the Americans, certainly the English, certainly my people, the Scandinavians. You know, and so these were not jabs and attacks. They were just simply pointing out where they're off track on something. And so he writes with love. He's a man with no enemies. It's a really unfortunate accusation. I'm happy to defend Chesterton, and I'm also happy to debate anybody publicly who makes the accusation.
Yeah, it's a lazy, simple way to try to cancel somebody. Because like you said, if Chesterton can have an impact today for good, those who are not for good, it's like, well, we can just cancel him and we don't have to deal with him. But it really is a lazy shortcut instead of actually, I mean, if you want to find criticisms of his work, go ahead. I mean, actual criticisms. Yeah, let's talk about it if you want to. But just this idea, okay, he's an anti-Semite. It's insane. So. Okay, so let's move on. So I mentioned at the opening program that he's had his legacy has had a major impact in the world, but particularly in the area of education, in which you are very much a part of. So why don't you tell us, what is the Chesterton Schools Network?
So the Chesterton Schools Network is a group of classical Catholic high schools based on the first one that I helped found in the Twin Cities in Minneapolis, Minnesota, 15 years ago. And it is a very tightly created curriculum, very integrated and very Catholic. And the other great thing is that we make it also affordable. But these are all these schools now around the country and in other countries have all been started at the local level. It's a grassroots movement of creating high schools and parents really taking control of their children's education when education, as we know it across the board, is really in crisis.
Yeah. So when you started this school, the Chesterton Academy, correct? That's the name of the school. Okay. You started that in Minnesota 15 years ago. I just have to ask, how do you start a school? How do you say, okay, I'm going to start a school?
You know, that's the main reason these schools have been taking off, Eric, is because we show people how you start a school. And I think one of the inspirations for these people is that, well, if Dale Alquist can start a school, anybody can start a school. And it's true. But we actually came up with a formula that works, which, you know, it's a group of families that get together and they say, here's our curriculum. And they start getting a couple of key personnel to join them. And they publicize it to the community that they're involved with. If you can get 10 or 15 or 20 students for the first year, you start getting momentum, but you can do it with a minimal investment. You don't have to go out and build a building because of demographics being what they are. There's a lot of empty classroom space that is there to be rented and can be usually had for a song. And so it's a lot of time and effort and certainly some expense, but the point is it can be done. And we've come up with a system now where people can use our curriculum and our templates for how to actually run a school, how to start it, how to get it going. And it's a step-by-step process.
Yeah. So when you were starting off this first school, how many families did you have? How did you get, like, what was the building you used? And how did you just, I'm asking a lot of questions here on this one, but like, and how did you decide what the initial curriculum would be?
Sure. Well, I had that year had been invited to speak at some classical Catholic schools around the country. I do a lot of travel and speaking, and I looked at each one of their curriculums, and then plus my two older children had gone to a classical school that was not Catholic, and I basically took something from each of them and then created a whole plan of what I wanted to see in 4 years. And so I created the initial curriculum, and we've made a few refinements to it since, but it's pretty much the same curriculum that we came up with at the beginning. We found an old public school building that was not being used as for school, so they had some empty classrooms available. Other people were renting some other classrooms, and we got about 10. Well, we got 10 students for our first year. Going out and beating the bushes. We hired a headmaster who, you know, went to some home schools, went to some parish schools, and it was a word of mouth thing. And we started with 10 of the most miserable kids you've ever seen in your life, but they were the pioneer students, and it grew from there. And it was one of the things that helped inform it from the very beginning was not only G.K. Chesterton himself, but a really joyful atmosphere that has continued, I think, in each school to this day. It's a real joy to bring the Holy Spirit into a classroom, to be able to talk about the faith in every subject you're teaching, and to see how one thing is connected to the other thing, and watching their minds pop with recognition when they see a truth.
Now, are the Chesterton schools only high school?
Yeah, only 9 through 12, Eric. Yep.
Okay, only 9 through 12. Now, I'm looking at the curriculum here. I printed out from your website. Now, I'm going to link to the website on the show notes for anybody who's watching or listening so that you can go to it. And it looks like it's a pretty, in a lot of ways, it's a standard classical education. But I noticed that, for example, each year in their literature, they always read at least one G.K. Chesterton. To kind of give that flavor. So how is Chesterton part of the curriculum other than just the fact that obviously you read a text of his each year?
Yeah, well, the texts that we choose are very pertinent to what else we're studying. And taking it backwards, you know, everything's summed up at the end in senior year. We read The Everlasting Man, which is this book that just brings everything together, the history, philosophy, art, culture, mythology and theology, and everything they've been studying for the last 4 years is summed up in that book. Back up here to the junior year when they're studying St. Thomas Aquinas in philosophy, well, we read Chesterton's book on Thomas Aquinas, but they've also been reading the real deal in the Summa Theologica itself. Back up another year, sophomore year, the growth of the Christian world. One of these pivotal saints right at the beginning of the Middle Ages, Saint Francis of Assisi. And the beginning of that book is really interesting because that book just kind of sums up the history that leads up to St. Francis. You know, he says you can't start this. You can't start with the birth of Francis because that's to miss the whole story. So it's the background's very essential to reading that book. And then we also read Orthodoxy the sophomore year, which is a combination of different subject matter. So we teach part of the book in theology, we teach part of it in philosophy, part of it in biology, and part of it in theology. What's the one in literature? Yeah. So they see how this is what integrated thinking looks like. And then the introductory book to Chesterton is the one that I wrote, Common Sense 101, and that's to introduce the freshman to Chesterton.
Okay. Now, your students in most of these, like at your school and then also at the other Chesterton schools, do you find that they mostly come from homeschooling backgrounds or from Catholic schools, public schools that just kind of then decide to go with this? I mean, kind of where are your students coming from?
I would say about a third of them come from homeschool backgrounds, and probably a little bit more than a third come from parish schools. And then the rest are a real mix of coming either from public schools or other private schools that are not Catholic schools. And so you get that there's a real mix of students, but certainly homeschoolers, it's a very friendly place for them because it's founded by parents. And so we know the parents know that we're representing parents.
Right. Now, in your curriculum, it says it's a rigorous four-year curriculum taught through the lens of the Catholic faith. So how is this a Catholic school as opposed to a non-Catholic school? And does it have a relationship with the diocese typically? Are there priests that say mass there? Like, how does that all work, the relationship of the Catholic faith with the schools?
Sure. Well, every school is a local school, and it may or may not have a relationship with the diocese. Hopefully they do, because the bishop of that diocese welcomes the Chesterton Academy, and I would say increasingly that's the case. But sometimes the local diocese is threatened by the existence of a new school that might be considered as a rival to the existing schools, and so those schools just operate then as independent schools that teach the Catholic faith, but they can't call themselves Catholic because that word rightfully is controlled by the bishop. But they still arrange to attend Mass every day. And that's one of the things we require, that every school have daily Mass. And so if they're directly associated, you know, with the parish, that's where they have it. Otherwise, they will bus the kids to somewhere to have daily Mass. But that's an integral ingredient to the school, is to have the Eucharist every day.
That's great. That's great. Now, you mentioned earlier also about the schools being affordable. Now, I think this is probably, at least in my mind, from people I've talked to, in my own experience, the number one barrier. I mean, obviously, they're like Catholic schools, they just aren't that good. I'll just say it. But beyond that, even if the ones that are decent, it's just beyond the means of a lot of parents. And so how is it that Chesterton schools can stay affordable?
Yeah. That is just a huge issue, Eric, and it's one of the things that we wanted to make paramount when starting the school, because we wanted to be a pro-family school. And if you're a pro-family school, pro-life school, you can't make it impossible for large families to attend the school, right? And so there's lots of ways to save money in education. And you know what? There's lots of ways to waste money in education. And that's one of the main reasons why schools are so expensive, is because of the money that is just not being well spent at all. But we've already talked about the fact that we try to find existing buildings rather than trying to build a building or getting. We do not rely on a lot of technology. The primary technology we use in the classroom is called a book. So we don't have all those bells and whistles and the latest gadgets. You can run a science lab for hundreds of dollars instead of thousands of dollars. It's and still teach all the principles of science. You don't have to pay your administration way beyond what you're paying your teachers. In fact, you want part of your administration to be in the classroom teaching, especially in the early going. You rely on a lot of volunteer help. You want parents to be invested in the school from the beginning, not just dropping their child off and say, here, you take care of them. No, we want, you're part of the education. We are in loco parentis, but you are also our partner in raising, informing this young person's mind. And so there's lots of ways to cut costs. And even so, there's some people that still can't afford a low tuition, and we make it, a key to try to raise enough money so that you make it affordable for everybody and give scholarships where necessary. So fundraising is always going to be part of it, but it's very doable, very doable.
That's good to hear. I know, we've homeschooled for a long time, but early on, our oldest, she went to a local Catholic private school. I was even on the school board for a while. And I was at this time a software engineer, but it drove me crazy how much they tried to do all this technology stuff and they wanted to spend all this money on technology. And the funny thing is, they always thought I would be on their side because I was a tech guy. I was a geek. I was like, no, I don't think my daughter in first grade needs to learn how to use a tablet and Excel or whatever. It's like, that's not going to help her. And she's going to figure it out on her own, first of all. I mean, it's not like us old people that had to be taught that. But I do think there's a lot of money that probably goes to waste in a lot of institutional schools. So, and I did notice, like, I went to, before the podcast here, I was looking up some Chestertown Academy, see if there's one near me. There's one up in Dayton, which isn't too far from me. And one thing I noticed was, like, holy cow, the professors and stuff, the teachers, I should say, they're like professors practically. Yeah. I mean, they're expertise. So you're definitely not cutting corners on your teachers. I mean, one guy, he was just a teacher, and I mean, most colleges wouldn't have somebody as qualified as this guy was. He had a doctorate in the biblical studies, and I was just like, holy cow. So is that a focus? Is like really the money that is spent is trying to get high quality teachers?
Well, it's really something, Eric, because when we started the school, we had more applicants for teachers than we did for students. it's really true that there are people out there that want to teach in a school like this. And obviously we have to pay a living wage to folks who are young and have families and everything. And we do, but there's a lot of wonderful retired people who are, this is just their dream job. This is what they've been wanting to do, is teach the Catholic faith with their expertise. And they always make up a percentage of the faculty, especially when a school is launched. Some of these PhDs, they'd rather be teaching in this setting than they would in a college setting. They have much more autonomy and are able to really teach their faith, combining it with their own expertise.
Yeah, that's amazing. Now the Chestertown Academies schools are basically classical education. And I know there has been a growth, at least anecdotally I've seen it, of parents interested in their kids learning through a classical education method. Why do you think that is, that that's becoming more popular, not just among Catholics, I've noticed, but even among Protestants, and I think even people of no faith?
Well, Eric, you don't mind if I quote G.K. Chesterton, do you?
Probably would be appropriate.
So in his book, What's Wrong with the World, he says, the problem in the school today is that most students are exposed to educational philosophies that are younger than they are. Yeah. Think about that.
Yeah.
We are always experimenting on our children. We're always trying the latest educational philosophy. And it always fails, and so we try the latest one. And I think we're at the point where people are seeing through that and say, these new ideas are simply not working. Let's get back to the stuff that worked for a really long time before we decide to replace it. And the old way is still the good way, it turns out, in this case, especially when it comes to teaching truth. Education is truth in the state of transmission, says Chesterton. It's passing the truth from one generation to the other. And it's not teaching the latest and greatest new ideas. That's not what you're supposed to be teaching children. And I think there's that realization. That's one of the reasons for the growth in classical education. Our education system is in a mess because we are always trying new things.
Yeah, I heard somebody once say, I thought it stuck with me, that in the public schools today, they don't teach, they train. Basically, they just train people to be good little minions in on the factory or office, whatever the case may be, just be good and go along with everything. But they don't really teach. They don't teach you how to think or anything like that. And I would say classical education in particular, that's what teaching them how to think, kids how to think, not just to train them to be good little citizens of the collective, so to speak.
Yeah.
So, okay, so now tell us then about specifically the growth of the Chesterton Schools Network. So you started just 15 years ago with your own school, and now what would I say it was 50? Is it 50 schools now, high schools worldwide?
Yeah, our present number is 46, but there's 16 in the pipeline, so we'll have over 60 schools next year.
Wow, 16. So, and this is mostly in the United States, correct? But is it also outside?
Yeah, mostly, but the great majority of the United States, but we are in four other countries right now. So there's three in Canada, there's one in Italy, and of course there's one in Iraq, and one in Sierra Leone, West Africa.
Right. As you would imagine.
But, and I know that there's talk of one getting started in Ireland and one in Argentina. But yeah, all the rest are here in the United States, and the growth it's been wildfire because the second school only started in 2014. Okay.
8 years ago.
Yeah. And probably within, a 5 year period, there were maybe 10 schools. And now it's 10 new ones a year that are getting started. It's absolutely incredible. It's faster than we can even handle it. It's unbelievable.
Now, are most of these schools brand new schools, or does a school kind of convert to a Chesterton school?
Yeah, that's a good question. We've had a couple schools convert to, they were an existing school. They either decided to become classical, or they were classical and decided to become a Chesterton school. And we also have a few cases where we have a large existing Catholic high school, and there's a Chesterton Academy track within the high school. Oh. So we are obviously there at the invitation of the local bishop when something like that happens. And there's three or four of those around the country. But for the most part, it's either rising out of a K-8 school where they want to add a high school, or it's just a group of parents saying, we don't have any good high school options here, and let's start a Chesterton Academy.
Okay. So now, how would you say that, I'm not trying to rail too hard in this episode on regular Catholic schools, but how would you say, what makes Chesterton schools stand out from maybe your typical Catholic high school today?
Yeah, and it's a fair question to ask, because there is something different about these schools. And this is, there are some really good Catholic schools out there. There's some that are, their main problem is they're just imitating secular schools, and that's probably their main problem. They've got a system that is really no different from a public school. It just has a religion class added to it. And those are the schools that are visibly in trouble. What makes the Chesterton Academy different? Well, I mentioned the integrated curriculum. Everything that's being taught is connected to everything else that's being taught. A four-year philosophy curriculum. Most high schools have no philosophy classes at all. We have 4 years, so we're developing faith and reason. It's very important. We teach logic ninth grade, and they understand what a fallacy is at the ninth grade level. It's something they can take with them all 4 years as they're learning how to argue and reason and debate. And then a four-year theology program to go with it, which is not just a religion class, but they learn theological history, moral theology, the depth of the catechism itself, and how it applies to everything else. A four-year art program, Eric. We emphasize the arts along with the math and sciences. So it's not that we de-emphasize math and science. We still give them just a great exposure. But right up with them are the humanities and the arts. So they learn how to draw and paint. They all have to be in plays, so they act and they all sing for 4 years in a school choir, I mean, classes and just different levels of choirs that they're in for 4 years. So they're developing the artistic side too, not an elective, a requirement. And then daily mass. I mean, I would say that it's our integrated curriculum, 4 years of philosophy, the arts program. Those are the main things that set us apart.
That's great. Now, the graduates of the Chesterton schools, do they typically go on to college? Are there sorts of vocation, religious vocations coming out of them? Kind of what, I know it's a big pool at this point for 15 years, but kind of what would you say is typically for a lot of the graduates of these Chesterton schools?
Well, you know, I could talk about our first school because that's had the most graduating classes. That's had 11 graduating classes. Now the newer schools have had, you know, probably 4 graduating classes. What I can say is that these kids are going to the colleges of their choice, or they are going into the trade of their choice. They've had the equivalent of a 4-year liberal arts education. They don't really need to go to college if they don't want to, because they've been well prepared with knowing how to think and knowing how to use their reason, and they're ready to start a trade, and they can go right into that kind of work that wouldn't need a college education for it. So we have the plumbers and the carpenters and the electricians are starting right off, and they're making money instead of spending it in college. But then the ones who go to college are able to focus right away on a particular career that requires higher education, and they're really well prepared to do that. And then we have had an amazingly high percentage of young men who've entered the seminary. At our first school, 1 out of 8 of our male graduates have gone to seminary.
Wow. How about that?
Yeah.
It's interesting. One thing you brought, I've soured more and more over the years on college myself, and just the necessity that everybody has to do it like it's an extension of high school. Obviously, there's certain things you have to do it for, but not a lot you don't. And one of the things, though, that college is useful for, if you go to a good one, is the learning liberal arts, which are important. But when I was looking at your curriculum, I'm like, wow, they're going to get out of high school. They're going to have all that set. So you're going to have philosopher plumbers out there, which is great. I mean, because they can live, and it's still very important for them to know these things. And they're applying, like you said, they're starting to make money from day one, and they're providing a great service to everybody in doing stuff like that.
Yeah. And for those who do go to college, we've got an arrangement right now with Franciscan University of Steubenville, that they will give college credit for our junior and senior philosophy and theology classes. So they have a head start going into colleges, and those are transferable credits. And some other universities are starting to get on board and say, yeah, because these kids come in, they don't need to take these introductory courses. They've had the equivalent. And so it's reducing college fees and time spent in college to get their degrees.
Yeah, that's excellent. Because, I mean, honestly, because, and this isn't the fault necessarily of the colleges, but because the kids come in so ill-trained, you have to start very basic in philosophy and theology, things like that, because these kids show up, a lot of them who went to Catholic schools or public schools don't know anything. So I can see why they just say, you guys just skip to the junior classes who came from the Chesterton Academy.
That was really encouraging. It's just, you know, a great affirmation of what we're doing, you can imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so let's wrap it up here. Where can people find out about the Chesterton, first of all, about G.K. Chesterton, but also about the Chesterton schools?
Well, since we don't believe in technology, you have to put a letter on a horse and send it. No, you go to our website. For G.K. Chesterton, just go to chesterton.org. Lots of great information to introduce you to the work that we're doing for the Chesterton Society and to the man himself, chesterton.org. And then for the schools, if you're interested in starting a school or exploring that more, it's chestertonschoolsnetwork.org. chestertonschoolsnetwork.org.
And I'll put links to both of those in the podcast description so people can just click on them and find them easily. Well, this has been great. I mean, Chesterton obviously is awesome, but it's nice to see that he's not a dead figure in the sense that we just kind of learn about him from history, but he really is influencing young people today through the Chesterton School. So I really appreciate you coming on, Dale. This has been wonderful.
Delightful for me too, Eric. God bless you.
God bless you. Until next time, everybody, God love you.